Tomorrow night, the first debate between President Obama and wannabe President Mitt Romney. Both of them trying to learn the zingers, learn the lines, learn the facts and figures, and avoid the gaffes. And sure, there have been gaffes in virtually every presidential election year. One of the most famous was Gerald Ford back in 1976.
There is no Soviet domination of Eastern Europe, and there never will be under a Ford administration.
Did I understand you to say, sir, that the Russians are not using Eastern Europe as their own sphere of influence and occupying most of the countries there and making sure with their troops that it's a communist zone?
I don't believe, Mr. Frankel, that the Yugoslavians consider themselves dominated by the Soviet Union. I don't believe that the Romanians consider themselves dominated by the Soviet Union. I don't believe that the Poles consider themselves dominated by the Soviet Union. Each of those countries is independent, autonomous. It has its own territorial integrity. And the United States does not concede that those countries are under the domination of the Soviet Union.
That became a major theme of the 1976 presidential election, which ended with Gerald Ford's defeat and Jimmy Carter's election. You could actually hear Max Frankel, the moderator, shocked by President Ford saying that there wasn't communism in those countries of Eastern Europe. That's the sort of thing that candidates ever since then have tried to avoid, sometimes successfully, sometimes not so successfully. Here was some perspective on all that and the expectations for tomorrow night's debate is Ralph Begleiter, former journalist for CNN. He was their world affairs correspondent for two decades and is now the director of the Center for Political Communications at the University of Delaware. Hi, Ralph. How are you?
Hello, Paul. Good to be with you.
Nice to talk to you again. How much do gaffes like that worry these presidential candidates this year?
I think all the candidates are always worried about making a big mistake during the debates. I'm not so sure it makes that much difference in terms of the election. But as we've seen already in this campaign, various kinds of events that occur, some of them predictable, some of them unpredictable, can have an effect on the immediate aftermath of the event. And we've seen that happen with gaffes. We've seen it with events in the Middle East. And so the candidates, I think, are very worried about creating an event at the debate that could shift the public opinion polls in the days following the first debate. Whether that would hold up for Election Day is another issue, and with so few people in the country still undecided, I think you're talking about a relatively small number of people whose opinions will be importantly shifted as a result of the first debate.
One of the differences may be that in our current communications world, any gaffe is going to be amplified, not just by an opponent grabbing hold of it and running it in their campaign ads, but by three major cable news networks that will run those things incessantly, plus the internet where people can go back and watch it at their leisure.
And you've touched on a really important point, and that makes a big difference between the situation your listeners just heard with Gerald Ford's comment back in 76. Yes, that was replayed as well, and it was replayed on the broadcast networks at that time, who were the dominant form of communication. But today, virtually anyone can find that clip online, email it to a friend, post it to Facebook, send it abroad, mash it up and combine it with other videos, add their own commentary, their own voices, or their own words beneath it, and suddenly create something that isn't even authentic to the original event, but could be a total fabrication or a total mashup of what actually occurred. And that can really go viral very, very quickly these days. It's not at all uncommon for those kinds of things to have hundreds of thousands of hits within 24 hours of something occurring. So that's a new phenomenon as a result of the social media that we've only seen really in the last five, certainly less than 10 years, but really effectively only in the last 5 or 6 years.
Yeah, even more so than in 2008 when Twitter was really not even a factor at all.
That's right. Twitter was really not a factor in the 08 election. YouTube was already around, but it wasn't being used that much for politics at that time. Today, many of the ads that people see or I recall seeing are ones that they don't see on television because most of the candidates' ads don't actually air on national television. They air in specific target markets, and where people see them, these videos is online, and then, of course, they can copy-paste them, send them in an email, and so on.
You mentioned that we are talking about only a few percentage points of people who are still undecided about whether they're going to go Obama or Romney 5 weeks from today. So tell me, you said that they get a little bump sometimes out of one thing or another that may happen in a debate, but what does history tell us about the overall effect of presidential debates?
Well, the overall effect over time has been relatively small, but of course things have changed over history as well, and it's not really predictable how today's debates are going to affect the upcoming election. With a small number of people remaining undecided, it seems to me likely that some of those people who will be paying attention to what's going on at the three debates plus the vice presidential one could make up their minds on the basis of what they see, and the candidates have to be conscious of that. The two candidates know that not only are they reaching out to people who already have made up their minds, but they're reaching out to those relatively few people whose votes they could sway with something they say or something they don't say, or with a mistake they made during the course of the debates.
You talked about political commercials as well. One of the things that I'm curious about is in this DVR era, and this is a terrible thing for me to say because my profession requires commercials so that I can get paid, and we hope that our listeners listen to every commercial and patronize our advertisers. But the fact of the matter is, when it comes to television, there's a lot of flicking through commercials. I mean, I rarely watch TV live unless it's a sporting event, and so I'm not seeing a lot of these commercials except an extreme fast forward. How much of a factor is that, do you think?
Well, as I was saying earlier, I think that many people are viewing political commercials online these days and not necessarily seeing them on TV.
Yeah, but the vast majority of people aren't going to go online and look at political ads. They're only going to be exposed to them if they're on TV while they're watching something. And with people time-delaying things with DVRs, there's got to be some impact there.
I'm sure there is. But, Paul, remember, I mean, and you said you mostly watch yourself through a DVR, but do you watch the local news through DVR? Do you watch a newscast through DVR? Most people, I don't think, do that. They still are tuning in to their local news to hear the weather, the sports about their local team, the fire, the accident, the police action around town, and that's where most of the political commercials are having their major effects. Local stations are the ones that are able to program political commercials into their local content, not network content. And it's the newscasts and those morning news, what they call morning news programs, they're really not much news in them anymore,
that are the
scene for most of the ads. And then finally, I'll just remind you that remember that most of the ads being aired in this year's campaign are not happening in most markets in the country. You can probably travel across the country, stop in a wide variety of cities and never see a political ad because the candidates are focusing them on places where there are undecided voters, those few swing states that remain in the election.
Or you may see local campaign ads like we do here with McCaskill and Aiken and Nixon and Spence and all the rest.
That's true, yes. I'm sorry. I was speaking of the national candidates involved in the national debates.
I want to read to you something from The Atlantic's Elspeth Reeve, who says, while Obama and Romney need to not only avoid sounding stupid, they also have to avoid looking stupid. Quote, the fear is not that they'll misstate the size of the national debt, but that they'll roll their eyes when the other guy does. The candidate's most important and difficult task of the October 3rd debate will be controlling their faces. The road to the White House is strewn with the battered bodies of candidates revealed on a national stage to be eye rollers or sighers or fast blinkers, unquote.
I think that's probably a little bit of an exaggeration, but there certainly is a lot of litter on the debate stages to that effect. We've seen a lot of cases like that. Remember George H.W. Bush, taking a look at his watch. There's debates over what he actually was doing at that time. People saw it as if he were feeling the debate was a waste of time, and he was looking at his watch to see how soon it would be over. But Mr. Bush himself suggests that he really was concerned about how long the answer was that he was getting from one of the other candidates on the stage at the time, who was trying to call that attention to the moderator. Then, of course, Al Gore sighing in disbelief over some of the things his opponent was saying during the debates in 2000. So, yes, we've seen a lot of these sorts of things. I think the candidates want to both look presidential. I think Mitt Romney especially will be paying attention to appearing on this important stage as someone who could be viewed as a president of the United States. And I guess in terms of visuals, which is what you're referring to, remember that the debates are one of the very few places remaining in our political system these days where the two candidates are literally face-to-face on the same stage at the same time addressing one another on the very same issues focused at them by the moderators. And that's, for the moment at least, still a unique characteristic of the presidential debates.
Yeah, you mentioned the Al Gore sigh. I interviewed Daryl Hammond, who was the great impressionist from Saturday Night Live, who had trouble doing Gore for a long, long time until that debate, and then finally he realized, oh, if I play Gore as that condescending guy, I can get the voice and the attitude down perfectly. That sigh of Al Gore's against George W. Bush really helped Daryl Hammond figure out how to do that. Now, I want to play you one more clip. This is a clip from the year that Michael Dukakis was a candidate, the Democratic candidate for president, 1988. Roll it.
The first question goes to Governor Dukakis. You have 2 minutes to respond. Governor, if Kitty Dukakis were raped and murdered, would you favor an irrevocable death penalty for the killer?
No, I don't, Bernard, and I think you know that I've opposed the death penalty during all of my life. I don't see any evidence that it's a deterrent, and I think there are better and more effective ways to deal with violent crime. We've done so in my own state, and it's one of the reasons why...
Now, that was considered a shocking question by your then-colleague Bernard Shaw at CNN, but it also was shocking in Dukakis' response, not thinking, not, you know, reeling back at the thought of Kitty Dukakis being raped and murdered, and a lot of people saw that as cold and detached. But I'm curious more about your friend Bernard Shaw as the moderator then. We're going to have Jim Lehrer doing it this year and Bob Schieffer doing it this year. But we've already seen attacks on moderators in some of the Republican debates earlier this year, notably from Newt Gingrich against CNN's John King. How much of a factor does a moderator play in what happens between the two candidates and for the viewing audience at home?
Well, before I answer, I just want to put a plug in for my good friend Candy Crowley, who still works at CNN,
yep,
and who will be moderating one of the debates as well. You didn't mention her, but that's
You're
okay.
Right. And Martha Raddatz will be doing the other one, the vice
right,
presidential debate.
Right.
Yeah,
exactly. You know, one of the key things about being a moderator is making a determination, and for the record, I've never served as a presidential debate moderator, so I'm not speaking from experience on that. You have to decide whether you as a moderator want to be the news or whether you as the moderator want to melt into the background and be a kind of traffic cop, sometimes a bad cop, because you have to sometimes reel in the candidates, tell them they're going on too long, turn to the next candidate, and you have to be thinking very hard on your feet, very fast on your feet, about whether to move to the next question, new topic, or whether to follow up on this topic because there's more ground to be covered on it. And those decisions are very tough. I think my friend Bernie Shaw at the time made a courageous decision to ask a difficult question of a candidate who at that time was perceived by many people in the public to be, a bit chilly or a bit distant. And Dukakis himself afterwards said that when he looked at his answer, he didn't really see anything wrong with it. It was the right answer. You know, substantively, it was the right answer. But you've raised an interesting point, Paul, and that is that the candidates at these debates don't have to appear only to be presidential. They also have to appear to be people. And that's where Michael Dukakis failed in his response to that debate. Almost anyone watching that would have recoiled in horror and at least shown some emotion over the prospect of his own wife being raped, and Dukakis didn't do that, and that was not something he thought about, and that's what the candidates, too, have to be thinking about as they respond to the moderator's question.
And Mitt Romney will have to watch out for falling into the relatability trap that he fell into earlier this year when he turned to Rick Perry and said, I'll bet you $10,000 on this. And you know Rick Perry wanted to say, $10,000? Most of our viewers don't have $10,000. He didn't say it, but that's what a lot of people heard inside Rick Perry's head at that moment.
Well, you know, I think there's a big difference between the Republican debates that were held earlier this year, the primary debates. I mean, I'm not talking about political partisanship here. I'm talking about the primary season debates,
yep,
and the presidential debates. Now we're down to two candidates. The two candidates have made Herculean efforts to define themselves as different from one another. These debates are an opportunity to highlight those differences, to talk about their policies. And in the primary debates, it was more of a free-for-all situation where you had so many candidates on the stage, a dozen people on the stage at any time, each one of them trying to stand out from the crowd, and most of them not getting a chance to respond substantively on most of the issues asked by the moderator. So really a very different kind of format, a different situation, I think, for both the moderators and for the candidates here. I would be very surprised, let's say, Paul, I'd be very surprised if either President Obama or Governor Romney chose to attack the moderators, any of these moderators in the presidential debates, and I would be very surprised if any of the moderators in these debates chose to insert themselves as the major news story in any one of these upcoming debates.
I think you're probably right, Ralph, and I appreciate your insight as always. Thanks for your time.
Good to talk with you. Take care. Have a good day.
Ralph Begleiter, director of the Center for Political Communication at the University of Delaware, former CNN World Affairs correspondent, here with Paul Harris on the Big 550 KTRS.